It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, November 12th, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. A top House Democrat is flipped from his seat as Republicans make gains in Florida and New York.
The deteriorating economy and the rising crime. And so I think that was, you know, the biggest factor in why we picked up 4 seats here in New York.
I'm Ryan Schmelz. It's the question on everyone's mind. Why does it take so long for some states to count ballots? As the race for control of Congress once again went from election day to election days, we explain why some states are fast, some states are slow, and what can be changed to speed up the process.
The growth in these sort of more what we often call convenience voting is convenient for the voters, but it's inconvenient for the counters. And so they've been overwhelmed.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. There aren't as many as predicted, but it's likely there will be a group of newly elected incoming members of Congress who will become the majority makers, those Republicans who flipped seats, beating in some cases Democrat incumbents. One such potential majority maker is Congressman-elect Michael Lawler. Not only did he beat a Democrat in his suburban New York City district, but upended the Democrat in charge of electing Democrats nationwide, the Democratic National Congressional Committee Chairman Sean Patrick Maloney. Maloney was a member of Democratic leadership and has been in Congress for a decade. Lawler has spent the past 2 years in the New York State House and ran a campaign focused on 2 big issues, crime and the economy. We talked about how he flipped a district won by President Biden, his goals as he enters a new Congress, and his thoughts on the future of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, in New York especially, you know, Democrats control everything in Washington, Albany, and New York City for the first time in our nation's history. And I think voters here wanted to restore balance and common sense. They were tired of one-party rule and the woke progressive ideology that, frankly, is destroying our economy and making our communities less safe. And you know, on those 2 main issues of inflation and the cost of living and crime, you know, Democrats own it. And their policies have contributed to the deteriorating economy and the rising crime. And so I think that was, you know, the biggest factor in why we picked up 4 seats here in New York and are going to be sending 11 Republicans down to Congress come January. Which is the highest in years, coupled with redistricting, which certainly played a big role here in giving us a fair map after Democrats tried to gerrymander it.
Let's talk a little bit about that district. You know, sort of, I think as we think about it, sort of outside of New York, sort of viewed as sort of these northern New York suburbs, you win this race, at least by the latest count I saw, by about a percentage point. So several thousand votes. This is a pretty swingy district. Do you think about that? Is, you know, you sort of figure out how you want to govern and what kind of congressman you want to be?
Yeah, listen, this district is the immediate suburbs of New York City, Rockland, Westchester, Putnam and Dutchess counties. It's a D+3 on the Cook PBI rating. There's 70,000 more Democrats than Republicans. My current assembly district that I represent has 22,000 more Democrats than Republicans. It's a 2-to-1 Democratic district. So, you know, I've had to, in both elections, reach out across the aisle and earn the support of Democrats and independents and Republicans alike on the issues that matter. And I think for me, in doing that again, you know, as a member of Congress, I'm going to do what I always do, which is talk to everybody, work to get things done on behalf of my district, make sure that we are tackling the issues that matter to folks here, whether we're talking about the cost of living or crime or immigration or education. There's a lot of important issues and people want to see results. They're tired of gridlock. They're tired of partisan bickering. And I think, you know, as a member of Congress, that's going to be my focus.
The Republican, and it looks like a Republican majority, though probably a smaller one than we had expected, is going to have to find areas of common ground to at least pass legislation, right, to get it through the Senate, to get it signed by President Biden. What are those areas, in your view, that you kind of want to focus on and tackle on as you get into Washington now in the next couple of months?
No question. And, you know, I think it's also going to be incumbent upon the White House and the Senate, depending on how that breaks down, to work with the House as well. It's got to be a give and a take here. But I think my focus will be to tackle inflation, reduce the out of control, reckless spending down in Washington, increase domestic production of energy, tackle our poor southern border. I mean, we need to secure the border. You cannot continue to have tens of thousands of migrants coming into the country illegally, fentanyl pouring across our southern border. It doesn't work. Fortunately, under the Biden administration and one party rule in Washington, it's been a lot of groupthink rather than trying to come up with policies that work.
One of the ways that immigration has been handled previously, and it's not gone anywhere, but at least the proposals have always been a mix of enhanced, increased border security with some reforms to, say, the DACA program, trying to find these pathways to legal status or citizenship for those who are already here. What is your approach to immigration to border security?
So I think there's three prongs here, right? Number one, you have to secure the border. I mean, it's been talked about, and nothing has really gotten done. I mean, under the Trump administration, there was certainly progress, but the Biden administration has pretty much reversed course and allowed entry of over 3 million illegal immigrants in less than 2 years. So you have to secure the border. Number two, you have to deal with the legal immigration system. My wife is an immigrant from Eastern Europe. She came here over a decade ago. She earned her citizenship 2 years ago. So I understand that process. We've been through it. But it needs a lot of work. It needs to be fixed. People who want to come here legally, who want to contribute to our economy and our culture and our communities, we should be welcoming them, and we should be working to have a system that is workable towards coming here. The third thing is certainly, obviously, you have over 20 million people who are here illegally, and we have to deal with that. You're not rounding up 20 million people and kicking them out. Obviously, you have the DACA program, which we have to deal with. And you have to create a system here that will address the challenges, but also be fair in creating a opportunity for legalization. Whether that includes citizenship down the road certainly is up for discussion. But I think you have to come up with a system that works here to address the 20 million people plus who are here illegally.
There have been members of your party, members in Congress who are Republicans, who have suggested that perhaps it's time to end the U.S. financial support for Ukraine. Where are you on that question?
Well, as I said, my wife is an immigrant from Eastern Europe. She comes from Moldova. Her family lives on the Ukraine border, about 30 miles from it, as the crow flies. I've been to Moldova many times, and including near Transnistria, which is a Russian occupied area. Vladimir Putin is a vile thug and a dictator, and he cannot be allowed to succeed in his efforts to topple Ukraine. And I think if he is successful, many of those former Soviet satellite states are next on his drawing board. And I think we need to be cognizant of that. I think we need to be serious about finding resolution here and supporting Ukraine. In addition, you know, when Ukraine gave up its nuclear power, they had entered into a agreement with us, and we promised to provide support and protect them, you know, and I think we need to fulfill our commitments there. So, you know, I know many of my future colleagues are concerned about the cost and oversight, and I think those are certainly fair questions to be raised. And I think the Biden administration needs to provide a long-term plan here. But I think it is incumbent upon us, and it's in our national security interests, to support Ukraine in this war against Russia.
One of the first votes that a new member of Congress takes is for Speaker of the House. Do you have somebody in mind who you're planning on voting for that position?
Yeah, I will be supporting Kevin McCarthy. He was extremely supportive in my race here, working with us and tirelessly advocating for us. And, you know, I'm a big believer in sticking with the one who brought you to the dance. So I will be supporting Kevin McCarthy.
How do you sort of envision these conversations as you listen? The Republican Party is a big tent. It is, you know, just like the Democrats in the House have had their sort of internal disputes. We seem to sort of be seeing this play out a little bit now, at least in the news and through the media. What sort of Republican conference are you planning on kind of walking into here?
Look, I obviously, based on the results, it's looking like it's going to be a relatively narrow majority. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon all of us to work together to, you know, pass an agenda that the conference supports. And I think, you know, in any conference, you're going to have geographic differences. Mm-hmm. You're going to have some political differences. But that's nothing new in politics, and you work through it and you come up with the best policy agenda that you can that has the support of the conference. And that's what we'll work towards.
Have you given much thought to sort of the committees you'd be interested in serving in, maybe some of the oversight hearings you're interested in?
I'm interested in, you know, financial services, appropriations, foreign affairs, transportation, infrastructure. Those are certainly committees that I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. But definitely, you know, my objective, regardless of committee assignment, is to tackle the issues that matter to my constituents and the people who elected me.
I don't want to get too far ahead of the calendar, but obviously it's been talked about here over the last couple of weeks. Have you given much thought to who the Republicans nominate in 2024?
No, and obviously, you know, that will play itself out over the coming weeks and months. I mean, you know, the former president will decide what he's going to do. But I think, you know, we have a lot of people in the party over the last few years, rising stars, people who have, you know, won pretty impressively, like Governor DeSantis on Tuesday night. So we'll see how this plays out. And ultimately, the voters within a Republican primary will decide who's the best person to lead.
I'll finish with this. Have you had the opportunity to talk to some of your colleagues or, I guess, incoming colleagues? And I mean, I'm always curious when people join Congress, are there like members that you are sort of modeling yourself after? Are there those that you've kind of looked to as sort of an example of how you kind of want to go about the job?
So I've spoken to many of my, you know, soon to be colleagues, had a lot of good conversations. I'm really looking forward to getting to work with them to tackle these challenges. As I've said in the past, one of the people that I respect and admire and is a good friend is Pete King, the former congressman from Long Island. I think Pete always did a great job representing New York and standing up for his district. And, you know, advocating for Republican policies and principles, and, you know, and at times when he disagreed, you know, speaking out. And I think it's important to first and foremost represent your district and the people who elect you as you support the party and the conference.
Did it feel like an upset when you won?
You know, to be honest, no,
okay.
Because when I got into the race, I didn't run to lose. And I've done this before. I've defeated a long term Democrat incumbent in a 2-1 Democratic district. I know how to do it. And so, you know, I knew what I was getting into when I decided to run. I understood the map and the coalition that we needed to put together. And ultimately, the results didn't surprise me in the least.
Congressman-elect Michael Lawler, appreciate the time. Enjoy, I guess, the next couple of weeks here before it all begins, and I will see you in Washington.
Look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, sir.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
The last presidential election in the United States took place November 3rd of 2020. Fox News called the race on November 7th. Americans waited days to find out who the next president would be, with key battleground states like Ohio and Florida already called. Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania took several days to get enough ballots counted to call the race. Fast forward to 2022, Americans are once again left waiting well after Election Day to hear about key races for governor and control of Congress.
Very simple. We're a nation of 50 states, and we're a nation of over 4,000 counting jurisdictions, from townships in New England to parishes in Louisiana to counties in most of the rest of the country.
Arnon Mishkin is the director of the Fox News Decision Desk. He's followed and analyzed elections for years, including how different states and even counties count ballots.
And the states and the counties and the townships really make the rules for how votes are to be counted. And in the case of mail-in ballots, the big difference is some states say as soon as a ballot is received by the state or by the county is allowed to process that ballot, means check that is a registered voter, to do the process and then set it aside to be counted when polls close on election night. Other states are not allowed to even touch the ballots that arrive by mail until after polls close on election day. So states like Pennsylvania, which is typically one of the slow ones, but also Arizona, California, and the like, cannot really process all their ballots until polls have closed. So they have to go through a two-step process. The first one is process that ballot and say, okay, this is Joe Smith, and Joe Smith is a registered voter in this area, so his ballot will count. Then they put it in another pile, and then they count the ballots, obviously anonymously. After 2000, a number of states improved their systems, particularly Florida. And Florida has done a much better job of processing early, being ready to count immediately, and then counting and then releasing the vote fairly quickly. Arizona remains one of the slowest counting states. Nevada is a slow counting state. And ironically enough, California is a really slow counting state. Typically, it doesn't matter in California because it is statewide such a blue state. But many of congressional seats are toss-up seats at this stage, and they're in California, and so we may not know who gets the majority control of the Congress until after all those seats are decided.
And you kind of touched on several good points there, so we'll stick with California first. You know, California, from what I understand, has a very extensive mail-in ballot process, and then do they also not start processing the ballots until election day, like you just mentioned too, with some of those states?
I believe that's right. Yes, but even more, they allow ballots to be received after election day, so long as they're postmarked by election day, and so those ballots will count as well. And sort of to gather them up and count them is a challenging process.
And I believe Nevada also has that, where as long as the ballot is postmarked on Tuesday, they can receive it up until Saturday, correct?
That's right. Yes.
So a lot of this kind of creates a chain effect, which is leading us to where we have been in this election cycle, where we're waiting days to process some of these ballots and still wait and end up waiting quite a substantial amount of time for some of these races to come in.
Precisely. And the other thing that's happened, which has changed the system and made it newsworthy, if you will, is starting, you know, historically, Republicans tended to be the ones who were more likely to vote by mail, due to the pandemic. Democrats became quite enamored of the vote by mail process, and Democrats invested heavily in getting their voters to vote either in person or by mail, but particularly by mail. If you're organizing a voter and you say, please send in your ballot, and you know that they tell you they've sent in the ballot, you can check them off and start pressuring other people to vote for you. So the Democrats invested heavily in mail-in balloting. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, led the Republican Party to sort of fight against mail-in balloting, saying it was a wrong way to vote, people should vote in person, et cetera. And so what we had in 2020 in a big way was basically 65% of the mail-in ballots were Democratic ballots and 65% of the in-person election day ballots were Republican ballots. That number has the difference has shrunk a bit. But I think in this year, it's 60% of the mail-in ballots are Democratic, 60% of the in-person Election Day ballots are Republican. But what that means is if you're waiting on mail-in ballots, you're waiting to see how big is the number and how blue is it going to be. And you often in situations where the Republican is in the lead because of the Election Day vote, but the Democrat takes over or may take over because of the mail-in vote. And that is a sort of a wonderfully fertilized garden for all sorts of theories about what are nefarious theories about what could really be going on, even though there's no evidence that that's what's going on. But it does lead to a suspenseful night at minimum, or a suspenseful week at minimum, and the ability for conspiracy theories to foster.
Right. And kind of two follow-up questions to that. You know, do you think that this mail-in ballot and this extensive weight that we're seeing, do you think that creates doubt or has created doubt in the electoral process? And let's just answer, you can answer that one first.
I wouldn't say it's created doubt. It's allowed people who want to make statements to try to create doubt. When, you know, political leaders who should be saying, look, our government actually works kind of well. The process of vote counting is actually pretty good, even if it's slow. There's really, you know, is there voter fraud? Yes, there is some, but no one has ever shown it to be of a sort that could change the outcome of an election. And so it allows for all sorts of rumors to fly, which would be nice if they didn't fly. But that's the world we are covering, you and I.
And the snail pace counting, it's been the last two election cycles, 2020 as well as 2022. And we didn't really see this to the same extent back in 2018 or maybe even 2016. But do you think just the fact that we had a pandemic and a lot of people picked up the idea of mail-in ballots or absentee ballots, that might just be contributing to it, the fact that we have just more people doing it?
Oh, absolutely. There's just an incredibly growth in the volume of mail-in ballots in particular, which are a little more complicated to handle than election day votes. You know, before 2020, the number of early votes and mail-in votes had been growing, but still about 60% of the country voted on Election Day. In 2020, because of the pandemic, 60% of the people did not vote on Election Day. They voted either by mail or in early voting places, and that has held. And so Election Day has become a much smaller part of the process. And so the growth in these sort of what we often called convenience voting is convenient for the voters, but it's inconvenient for the counters. And so they've been overwhelmed. And the states and the counties have not changed the rules to accommodate that more efficiently or invested heavily enough to enable the process to work more rapidly. I mean, you know, we can. It's easy to sit in New York or Washington and make fun of Maricopa County and Phoenix. Maricopa is the second largest voting jurisdiction in the country, so they have a huge metropolis. It is a huge number of votes, and it's not just about. It's not simply about piling them into the computer scanner and have them scan and count. It's about sort of checking each one to make sure it is a real voter, and to make sure that they're counted fairly.
And there's also a signature verification, too, that kind of slows this down, right, also?
Yeah, the signature verification is the hardest thing, because that's the thing that requires a little bit of human touch and human handling, and that's the processing part. And that's the stuff that some states will do before Election Day or before the close of polls on Election Day, and they can get that stuff done. Because once you get a stack of paper ballots that you know are proper ballots, it's easy to stack that into a computer and have the computer scan and count. The difficult part is making sure that Arnon Mishkin's signature matches the Arnon Mishkin signature that you've seen over the years he's voted in the past or whoever. And that's the time-consuming process. And that's why if you ask me what they should do, they should figure out a way to process these ballots earlier.
And so are there examples of states that do that where they process earlier? I believe that Florida, Texas, and Ohio may be examples of that.
Exactly. You know, and guess what? We have the outcomes in all those races. Florida, Texas, and Ohio, you know, they were early in the early to move to much early voting, and they have a much better processes for managing that, and they process the ballots in advance. I mean, I understand the hesitation that some of these states have in processing ballots in advance, because you know what you don't want is a situation where the votes are counted in real time, and you can see, oh, team blue is ahead of team red, so now team red invests to get voters out to the polls. That's a recipe for real problems. But the notion of having a mail-in ballot, you see the sealed envelope which contains their confidential ballot choices, but on the outside you see another ballot that says this is the vote of Arnon Mishkin. And that's what I think states need to adopt the systems they have in place in Florida, Texas, and Ohio.
And speaking of Florida and kind of staying on Florida, obviously they came into a lot of controversy in the early 2000s during the Bush-Gore election. You know, what have they done differently since then to make this a little more smooth?
They've invested much more heavily in improving the processes. And then I think they moved to processing ballots in advance following 2000. A lot of because they realized that they did not want to, you know, they kept America on the edge of their seat for basically 44 days, I think, after Election Day, before we finally realized that what the final score was, which was Bush winning by slightly more than 500 votes.
And so with these states that are traditionally slower, is there anything that they could change? And do you expect leaders within those states to try to address this before the next election cycle?
What they can change is processing time, you know, when you can process this, which is a simple law, and investing more heavily in sort of more the ability to process these ballots. But, you know, state governments are under budgetary strength, so I don't see them doing that. I do see enormous pressure that you'll see in the western states and Pennsylvania and the others to try to move to process the ballots in advance. And part of that's going to be, I mean, I think that part of that is going to be about getting both parties, I think, aligned, that it doesn't matter how someone votes so long as they vote. And I think that you know, that there is, you know, some parties have embraced a mail-in balloting in a way that other parties have not. And I think that the more that both parties can agree that this is the proper way people should vote, the easier it will be for election counting. And by the way, the harder it is for campaigns, but that's their problem.
And I think one more thing needs to be touched on, too. One state that we're waiting on is Alaska, which has been slow for a last couple elections. And one of the reasons is because they have switched over to a ranked choice system. Now, how do you think that's going to play? And could you see more states pursue this type of vote? And will that kind of make this even longer if more states go into it?
Well, Alaska has all sorts of problems. As I understand it, and this may be an apocryphal story, but it's too good not to tell anyway, which is some places in Alaska deliver their ballots to the vote counting centers by dog sled. So that process in Alaska has always taken weeks. No one has ever known who really is the winner for a long time. And now they've added to this the ranked choice voting. And in some cases, ranked choice voting is a good thing. I think that it's been pursued by what I call the goo-goos, the good government types, because what ranked choice voting allows you to do is you vote for your first choice, and you say, if my first choice is not in the final round, this is my second, third, and fourth choice. So if you have four candidates are running, the fourth place finisher in that first round is eliminated, and they count up who that person's second choice ballots are. And that is why, actually, the Democrat was able to win in Alaska, because you had two Republicans, Sarah Palin and another Republican, who were running. A lot of people loved Sarah Palin. Very few people thought Sarah Palin was her second choice. She was someone you loved or hated. And so when Sarah Palin wound up in second place, the other Republicans' voters had actually put down the Democrat as their second choice. And so she wound up winning. Whether or not we turn, you know, and so, but So you could argue it's a good thing because you could have two Republicans running. They're not really splitting the vote because they're sharing the vote at the end through the ranked choice process. You could also say it's not a good thing because it's it makes it a lot more complicated for voters, particularly when you have a large number of voters of candidates running. I think that I imagine that more and more states will embrace some form of ranked choice voting, but I can't predict when.
Now, is there a way to do ranked choice and have it be quick?
No, it turns out there really isn't, because in order to eliminate the in any given round, you need to have finish all the counting of all the rounds, all the candidates to decide who really is in last place. So you have to wait for all the ballots to be counted. And only then can you move to the second round. There's no way to have a computer say, OK, candidate A's second choice is candidate D, and then and have it sort of automatically assign things like you might in a football draft. So that's why we probably won't have everybody embracing ranked choice voting. And ranked choice voting often, you know, it's one of those things that doubly annoys all the campaigns, because it first annoys your campaign because if you're a loser, you're one of the second chance. And then it annoys you even further if you're actually in second and you find out that, as Sarah Palin found out, that a lot of Republicans didn't think of who voted for the other Republican first, did not put her as second choice. They put Mary Peltola as second choice.
Arne in Michigan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, more women will be holding office across the country after this week's midterm elections. Fox's Kevin Cork takes a look at the shrinking gender gap in government. And Jessica Rosenthal does our midterm deep dive on the issues that mattered most in Democrats stemming a red wave. Until then, I'm Jared Halpern. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Please rate and review this podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.